Dear listeners, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this podcast. We have our honorable guest today is Ambassador Dr. Ali Ajami. Dr. Ali Ajami, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks.
Dr. Ali Ajami was born in Lebanon on September 1, 1952. He's married with four children. He has a bachelor's degree in Arabic language and literature from the Lebanese University in Beirut in 1982, a master's in Arabic language and literature from the Lebanese University of Beirut, 1985, and a PhD in Arabic language and literature from the Lebanese University in 1998. He started in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Beirut in 1992, worked in the Consul of Lebanon in Cairo from 1994 to 1996, then in the Consul of Lebanon in Brazil, in Brasilia, Brazil, in 1996 to 1998, Consular at the Embassy of Lebanon in Brasilia from 1998 to 1999, and the Consular of the Embassy of Lebanon in Muscat, Sultanate of Oman, in 1999 to 2002. Then in June of 2002, he worked in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Beirut as the head of the Asian, African, and Australian desk. In April 2004, he became the Consul General of Lebanon in Detroit, Michigan, and he remained in that post till August of 2007. In August of 2006 till August of 2007, he was also the Dean of the Consular Corps of Detroit. In August of 2007, he became the Ambassador of Lebanon in Abidjan, Côte d'Ivoire. And then in June 2013, became the Ambassador of Lebanon in Stockholm, Sweden, and remained in that post till September of 2016. He is also a poet. He has published 9 books in Arabic language, the last of which is a book of poetry. We will dwell more into the personal history of Dr. Ali Ajami in this podcast series. We will start from the beginning with Dr. Ali Ajami. Again, welcome to the podcast and thank you for giving us your time.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start in the beginning. Your childhood memories. What are some of the things that have remained with you from your childhood memories, from the elementary age, that are still with you today?
Yeah. A lot of things that can never fade away. Just like when you smell a rose, it always clings to your nostrils. It can never go away. I remember that, you know, I'm from a small village. It's not anymore small. It's now a city. It's called Abbasiyye, South Lebanon. It's about 5 miles away from Sur. And I was studying in Sur. My school was in Sur. At that time, we didn't have money. So I was supposed on daily basis, mostly, to go on foot from my house to the school and back home. I will never ever forget this, no matter what the weather is, stormy, raining, hot. Can you understand? Can you just think of it? Going to school 5 miles a day, back and forth, every day, for about 9 years.
Wow.
So it's this memory can never go away.
Mm-hmm.
I can never forget my grandma when I'm late sometimes. She would be waiting under the I don't know exactly, aloes, what's the name, shajar aloes in Arabic, in English,
almond trees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had an almond trees at the entrance of the house, and she would be waiting under the almond trees.
Mm-hmm.
She wouldn't go down to the house before I arrive. I can never forget this.
Mm.
You know, it's really something not never ever would fade away from my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I had so hard time, and that what built up my personality.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you walk alone to school?
Most
of the time.
I didn't have enough money. At the time, it was very pennies to pay for a taxi.
Mm.
We have a local... I remember at the time, we have only three taxis going from Abbasiyah to Sour.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have enough money to pay for the taxi. And sometimes, if I have the money, I love to go to movies.
Mm.
So I would just keep the money, go to the movies, and come walking back home.
Wow, so yeah. And you're talking about early 60s. There was a theater in Sour?
Yeah. We have at that time three theaters. We have Cinema Alhambra, we have Cinema Dunia, and we have Cinema Rivoli.
Mm.
Three of them were very famous, and I loved it. I think this was the reason behind my wild imagination. Most of the stories I wrote, I was nourished by that experience. You know, sometimes when I go back to my village, to my friends, I wanted to brag about what I have done. I have been to the movies. I have to tell them about what I have seen. Sometimes I didn't have money to go into the movies. What I would just go to the entrance of the theater, watch the photographs, Hercules, and I don't know what, and then I will just collect a story.
Mm.
From the photos I'm seeing, and come back home, and when I sit down with my friends, I recount to them what I have seen.
Mm.
I didn't see. I wasn't in the movie. I was just watching and building up.
You use your imagination to create
exactly.
A story.
Mm.
What kind of movies these theaters showed?
Most of it was Hercules, Antara bin Shaddad, something like
this. Was it Egyptian film?
No, not only Egyptian, Italian, Western movies sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Do these theaters still exist today?
Most of them, they were demolished and they rebuilt huge centers. I think there was some person tried to revive Alhambra theater, and they refurbish it, and they try to, but I don't know that this will work out,
mm-hmm.
because people are not so fond of going to movies.
Mm.
They would see all the movies online. They would see all the movies on the TV and so on.
Mm-hmm, During these trips, the 5-mile trips daily from home to school, I mean, it was raining sometimes.
Yeah.
What did you do in the rain?
Either hide till... Hide under trees.
Did you have an umbrella?
No, unfortunately.
Uh-huh.
Let me tell you something. At that time,
uh-huh.
from my village to Sour, for these 5 or 6 miles, it was all orchards of lemon. You could smell the beauty. Now it's no more. If you go from Abbasiyah to Sour, it's all buildings. Everything turned out to be buildings. It was really something lovely to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I love doing it.
Yeah. Do you feel that trip that has been interwoven in your childhood growth has contributed to the poet in you?
For sure. It injected me with this feeling of love for nature, feeling of love for strength. I thought early enough that I should be strong enough to survive. I always, all what I have done is based on one main factor, my late mother. She was the one who raised us, me and my brother and my sister.
Mm-hmm.
My father was just left us. He went to Africa, to Liberia, where he lived there for a long time, and he got remarried again. So it's my mom who is behind everything I did.
Mm-hmm.
The strength I have belongs to her.
Mm-hmm.
I got it from her. Mm-hmm. The love for others, the love for service to others. That's what I've been doing during all my diplomatic missions, to serve people. Mm-hmm. I learned how to really be a good servant from her. She was, you know, she was illiterate. Mm-hmm. She never went to school, but she learned how to read Quran perfectly well. I don't know how. Mm-hmm. And from there, she was an excellent teacher to us, me and my brother and my sister. Mm-hmm. That woman can never be forgotten. Never, ever. She passed away almost 10 years away now. Mm-hmm. And when she passed away, I can feel it till now. Mm. Something deep within the heart was broken. Can never be. Can never be back again.
Yeah. Allah may she rest in peace. What's your what high school you went to?
At that time, it's called Al Ittihad. Ittihad High School. I was there at the same school from third grade till high school. Mm.
Was it a public school?
No.
It was a private school.
Private school. And my mom insisted. Mm-hmm. You know, that's something interesting to tell you. Mm. My mom was a very hard worker. She used to go work at farms, orchard farms, banana farms, whatever, any, for, I think, $1 or $2 a day, just to make us, me and my brother, go to school. She refused. She refused the idea that one of us might leave school, might quit. No. She kept working and working and working. Mm-hmm. See what I have achieved, what I have earned in life, goes back to her. What my brother is a doctor, physician. He's in Ivory Coast. Also, it goes back to her. She is someone.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming that your high school experience was in the 60s, right? Late 60s. What's your recollection of Lebanon in the late 60s?
It was so beautiful. It was so lovely. If you compare Lebanon at that time and Lebanon of today, there's a huge gap. Anything you look at that time it was bright. We were poor. Poverty was so hard, but the life was lovely. Lovelier than now. Even if you have money. Mm. You have been to Lebanon, Wissam, and you know exactly what does it mean to live down there. You need money. You need, the situation is no more peaceful, easy to go through as now. Now it's really hard. Really, really, really tough and hard. At the time, it was more and more peaceful, very peaceful. If you would tell me what do you prefer now and that time? No, I prefer that time, for sure. Then I would love to go back there. If Lebanon will go backwards to that time, it will be much, much, much more better, much more better, far more better. Mm-hmm.
The schools used French curriculums at that time, correct?
No, it was English.
It was English.
Yeah, that school was English.
How come?
Some of the schools in South Lebanon was teaching English curriculum, and
British curriculum?
No. It's a Lebanese curriculum, but English language, not French. Although at that time, French language was dominating, you know, the headmaster of the school was a Palestinian guy, Salim Shammas, Allah God.
Bless his soul.
Bless his soul. He was a Palestinian, and Palestinians were pro-English, not pro-French.
Because they were colonized by the British.
That might be a reason. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the books that you had? Where were they produced?
I know it's really not easy to remember. You're talking about 50 years or even 50.
So the history, the geography.
The same as the Lebanese curriculum that was taught, but I mean in English.
In English. Mm. Did you find that since the majority at that time were all speaking French, Did you find it difficult to engage in intellectual exchanges?
No. Not at all. Mm-hmm. Not at all. And don't forget that starting by the late 60s, the trend to where English language started.
Mm-hmm. You finished high school. What's the story of continuing your higher education?
Yeah. At that, I was very bright in math. Mm-hmm. And in biology, and I wanted to be either an architect or a physician. So I finished high school, looked around me. I don't have financial capacity to do either, both of them. At that time, 1970, where I finished my high school, mm-hmm. There were no branches of the Lebanese University in the south. At all. There was the main branch, the only branch was in Beirut. I didn't have enough money to go to Beirut. And it wasn't easy to go to a faculty of medicine or a faculty of... I refused to go to university. Either I go there or no. Mm. So I started working as a teacher at that time. And I continued refusing to attend any university till 1978. Mm. 8 complete years, I started teaching. But despite this, I mean, I couldn't, to go to a private school, a private university like the American University, for example, it costs thousands of dollars. I didn't have it. Mm. I didn't. So by 1978, I found that I have to do something. I convinced myself that I should do something, and then I applied and I went to the faculty of literature and arts, and I did Arabic language, and I continued from there. I did my BA, and then my MA, and then my PhD, and then the same faculty, same university in Lebanon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 1978 and 1982, you got your first bachelor's degree.
Yeah.
What were you working at the same time?
Yeah. I was working both
as a teacher.
Uh-huh. And 1978, I started additional work as a journalist.
Mm. Teacher, where did you teach?
In my hometown, Abyssinia, in public school.
Mm-hmm. What grades did you teach?
I started teaching high school, mm-hmm. elementary school. Mm-hmm. I was teaching everything. Then I focused on Arabic language, and then I tend to be the assistant director of the school.
Mm-hmm. That's before you were 30.
Yes, before I was 30.
Right.
Yeah.
So in your 20s, you started.
I was 18 years of age when I started teaching.
Teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Did you like teaching?
To me, till now, and mm-hmm. I say it everywhere. I have been a teacher, a journalist, and a diplomat. If you ask me to choose one of them, which is the best, I will tell you teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Just for a simple reason. At that time, I don't know how things is turning now, but at that time, a teacher was playing like God. You are creating.
Mm.
You are creating the minds. You are building up people, just like God. You are a creator.
Mm.
I think now things have changed tremendously. But yes, at that time, I would always prefer to be a teacher.
Mm-hmm. Tell us the story of becoming a journalist. How did you stumble upon that?
You're
talking 1978, that's after the war. After the war
started, yes. I at that time I had a very close friendship with one intellectual in Beirut, and they were starting to initiate publishing a new magazine for kids.
Mm.
It's called Samer.
Mm-hmm.
So he invited me to join in. I was at that time starting to write short stories and show them to this man. His name is Nasser Sayeh.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of the prominent intellect in Lebanon, and he invited me to join in because I was writing some short stories for kids, and this magazine was for kids. Mm-hmm. So that was the first step in journalism journey. I started working with the Samir magazine till 1982. Mm-hmm. And I was still teaching at the same time. 1982, after the invasion and occupation of Israel to our part of Lebanon, South Lebanon, mm-hmm. I was called upon by the certain magazine there to be their correspondent, and in South Lebanon, and from there things began accumulating. Mm-hmm. From 1982 till 1988, 6 years, I was the correspondent of Agence France-Presse, Reuters, plus in all together was about 15 to 16 newspapers, magazines, radio stations, mm-hmm. in the Arab world, in Lebanon.
Mm-hmm. You were freelancing too.
Freelancing. Mm-hmm. And
in Arabic,
mm-hmm. but no, for Reuters, I have to write to send them in English, and to Agence France-Presse, they have their offices in Beirut. Mm-hmm. So it was huge, you know, Sam. If you think of it, how could you be a journalist under occupation? Now, when I hear about what happens to journalists in Syria, for example, or in Iraq during the war, I remember very well. Mm-hmm. It's so interesting to mention that at that time we didn't have
cell phones,
we didn't have media, we didn't have satellites, we didn't have all these. So the way to send the news to your journal, to your magazine, or to the offices in Beirut, it was really a tough mission. Sometimes we would hire taxis. If you want to send a movie, I mean a film, a pellicule, to take photographs. I was also photographer for mm-hmm. for Agence France-Presse and for Reuters. Mm-hmm. It was really a tough period, mainly from 82 to 85. It was really, I was in danger all the time, mm-hmm. all the time.
Okay, before we want to dwell more into the subject of the 1982 invasion, mm. but before that, 1975, the civil war broke in Lebanon. How do you recollect that, and how much did it affect your life?
To be clear enough, in South Lebanon, to a certain limit, to a certain extent, we were away from that civil war, mainly in our part, which is Sur area. And, mm-hmm. We were not in the civil war. Okay, mm-hmm. we were following up what's happening in Beirut mm-hmm. and in other areas, but in our part of the world, we were out of war. Mm-hmm. No massacres, no cleansing, whatever happening in Beirut or in the mountain area. So we could say that in South Lebanon, we were away mm-hmm. from the war.
But you had a big influx of Palestinian.
It didn't affect us mm-hmm. till the moment that the Palestinians were in charge. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a certain part of history in South Lebanon from 1975 till 1982. The area was under the Palestinian control. Mm-hmm. They were controlling everything. Mm-hmm. But this doesn't mean that we were in war. Mm-hmm. South Lebanon was out of...
Yeah. How was your relationship with the Palestinian presence a military presence, right? And a militia presence in South Lebanon. Was there any conflicts or confrontation?
Between the people or... No, the people were...
Not the people, the militia people.
Mm. We never... any. We, I mean, when you are... if somebody is controlling you and he has all the elements to control you, I don't want to use the word to suppress you, to control you, and you don't have any power to resist or to refuse, or things were going on like this. I know that there was some kind of resistance from some parts in South Lebanon against, mainly when it comes to social activities. You know, sometimes people wouldn't find even food, we didn't find even bread to eat. Why they could see all the bread going the other side, it had an impact, mm-hmm. but not to this, because in general the Lebanese in South Lebanon were supporting the Palestinian cause, mm-hmm. until now. I don't think there is any people in the Arab world that knows exactly and that supports exactly the Palestinian cause like the Southerners.
Right. Okay. 1975-1982, the
invasion.
The Israeli tanks marched for the first time inside Sur. Did you wake up to the Israeli tanks entering your town?
I was in Beirut at the time. Mm-hmm. Because I was working as a journalist, mm-hmm. and my family was in the south in Abyssinia. My mom was in Syria going to Sid Zainab, mm-hmm. and my wife with my two kids at the time were alone in Abyssinia, and I couldn't go back because suddenly they were surrounding Beirut, mm-hmm. the Israelis, and there were no way to communicate with the family. So I waited in Beirut. I survived because, you know, you have to live at that time to feel exactly what it looks like. Mm-hmm. The daily, every minute bombardment of Beirut was something horrible. Mm-hmm. You could run from here to there, to there, to there. And I remember at the time we used to go and hide at the Safir newspaper building and then the shelter down, and it was really a tough year. I waited in Lebanon and Beirut for 2 months before having the chance to go back to my hometown.
Was there communication? The phones were working
at all? No. We could follow the news through people coming and going. Mm. Some people were managing to go, but I mean, in fact, no. I waited till my mother came back from Sid Zainab to Beirut, and then we went together, mm-hmm. me and her, back to, after 2 months.
Israel was inside Beirut at that time?
It was before. They were at the border. Okay. They were on the and the entrance of the airport.
Okay. How long did that last, the siege of Beirut?
About two months. The second day they were mm-hmm. on the edges of Beirut.
So after you left Beirut, Israel...
Yes, after Israel, that they came. Yeah.
Okay. And at that time, so 1982, you started your correspondence job, or, you know, freelancing for a group of... news agencies,
very newspapers, TVs, radios. Yeah.
So tell us more about that experience. Was it a daily? So did you leave teaching at that time?
No, I was still a teacher all that time. Till 1992, I was still a teacher. I was working journalism, an additional job. Officially, I was
teaching
a teacher.
In Abbasi.
In Abbasi.
So even when you're a correspondent in the middle of the war, you're still teaching.
Exactly.
It's very interesting. So, I mean, that's a hot time for news. There was a lack of correspondence. There's a high demand. Was there any form of training for journalism, or is it just something that you've learned by experience?
I was very, very, very...
interested.
not interested. I was very good in Arabic language and letter. And I mean, I can write. I was till now I'm perfect in writing.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember at that time in Sur area we were only three journalists.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Only three. Me and the correspondents of Safir newspaper and Annahar newspaper. That's it. And I was, I could say it simply, I was the only intellect among them.
Mm-hmm.
I would be writing reports.
Mm-hmm.
And they would be copying my reports and sending. I didn't mind at the time.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that I was really reflecting on how to make the news reach worldwide.
Right.
And I did it well. I did it well. Mm-hmm. And, even
what about photography? Were you trained on photography?
No. I just.
You bought a camera or they gave you a camera?
I had my own camera, not then. And I was, at that time, there were no digital cameras. You know,
yeah, of course, yeah. Do you still have any of those phones?
Oh, yes, I remember when I went to Switzerland in 1989, I did an exhibition.
Nice.
For those photographs in Switzerland in
1989.
Yeah.
You still have them? You still have?
I don't know.
Hmm.
I can't. They should
you
be
still
somewhere.
Have the film, the black film? No.
I have a lot of black films, but I think most of them were destroyed.
Mm-hmm. It would be worthwhile to resurrect these documents. Yeah. Tell us, doctor, about your experience. 1982, 1983, that's very, very a tense time in that area. So you're the correspondent in Sur.
Yeah.
That's a tense time in Sur. When the occupation lasted in Sur till
1985. Yeah.
There were the first suicide mission happened in Sur at that time.
Yeah.
The emergence of
resistance,
the Islamic resistance.
Before it was the resistance.
1982.
The resistance started 1982
mm-hmm.
against the Israeli occupation.
Mm-hmm.
It at that time there were no any Islamic resistance.
Mm-hmm.
It was the resistance in general, and it was led by Amal movement.
Mm-hmm.
And I still remember at that time there were two major leaders for Amal movement. They were really exceptional. From one part, Dawood. From the other part, who was the real resistant leader, Muhammad Saad. Muhammad Saad was from Ma'arakeh, and I was in very excellent relation with him. And when I was arrested by the Israelis in 1985, they just wanted to know how do I know him? Where do I meet with him? I was the only person to meet with him of the journalists. I was the only one. If he wants to give a statement, he would send someone over to me because there were no phones, talkie-walkie something, mm-hmm. to come to where he is. He never had a stable place. Or every day he's moving. And the time he had a stable place, they managed to kill him. They managed to execute him whenever they... That's mm-hmm. what I told... I remember very well once... Maybe 2-3 weeks ahead before he was assassinated, I told him this. I told him, Muhammad, I mean, you were just like a ghost to the Israelis because you don't have a place. Now you have a fixed place in Ma'arakeh. This is not good. And it happened.
Yeah.
They bombed his Husseiniyah.
Among your reports during your correspondence time, what do you feel was the most important report you wrote?
I was reporting daily.
Mm-hmm.
I never missed a day. I was beside the daily news. I would write some reports,
mm-hmm.
Weekly reports. I used to publish them at Al Kifah Al Arabi. I remember one of them was it's called The Israeli Blindness in Color.
Nice.
What do I mean by that? What did I meant by that at that time? You know, the Israelis used whenever, mainly in the beginning of the in the occupation to my part of South Lebanon, they used to put marks. For example, in Hebrew, for example, this is Sur with
an arrow.
Yeah, with an arrow. Or this is Abbasiyya, or this is whatever. Mm-hmm. So you know how the resistance at that time started to do to them? They would create an ambush, prepare an ambush somewhere, and they will turn this arrow the other side. Mm. So the convoy, Israeli convoy that would be coming to Sur, for example, they will go behind this arrow to the ambush. It was really interesting at the time. Mm. I used, when I remember them with pride. What we did, what the Lebanese population in South Lebanon mm-hmm. Did to face Israeli occupation was more than wow. Hmm?
Did you have any? Other than the what led to the arrest? Did you have any confrontation with the Israeli army at that time, as a journalist?
No. Hmm. Actually, more than one time we were going with my colleagues, the journalists, to cover. You know, the Israelis used to attack certain villages, to go into them, to collect the men to one side, women to one side, and some kind of suppression. So more than a time, they would stop us. But when they know that we are journalists, they would leave us. Mm-hmm. But the arrest was something different. Mm-hmm.
1985, what was the story of the arrest?
It was in February, I don't know exactly the date, I think 12th February, and it was a very cold night, very rainy, and suddenly they came to my house and bang, they had this type of maneuver just to make you, to frighten everyone. They would surround the house and they would be sitting, standing on all the doors and entries to the house, and they would start banging, bah, 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 on all the doors and all the windows. Yeah. And then they went into the house with the mayor of our village. And you will be amazed to know that I did not wake up to their bangs.
Yeah.
I was sleeping in the bedroom with my wife, and then I just waked up to the voice of my mom. Mm. Ali, wake up, they came for you. Just mm-hmm. so quiet.
Wow.
I wake up and they was there.
As a journalist, you're used to bombs and it's a time of war, so probably, yeah.
So they took me and they blindfolded me and mm-hmm. And I was there only for 24 hours. Mm. And
but you didn't know that when you went.
I didn't know that I will be, yeah, I didn't know that.
But at that time, they used to send people Mukhayyam Lansar.
That's true. That's true. Mm-hmm. So, during the arrest, there was a real tough experience with this
bag.
The bag they put on your head. I wrote a story about it in my latest book, Halat. It is in it. Mm-hmm. In a moment, you see nothing. Mm-hmm. And the only thing you know that you are smelling all the people that came ahead of you into that
bag. Interesting.
Yeah. And one of the soldiers will be driving you. You know, the bag, it has a lace. Mm-hmm. They will be just driving you just like an animal, just like a donkey or whatever, the way you drive a donkey. And when at last I went into interrogation, there were four of...
Do you know the location? Where was that?
Yeah, it's nearby Sur, mm-hmm. nearby the Al-Bas area. Mm-hmm. They have a headquarters there mm-hmm. in Madrasa al-Shajara. There was an attack later on mm-hmm. it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And...
Bilal Fahs.
No, Bilal Fahs al-Zahrani.
Who was it? Qasir?
Ahmed Qasir, no. It's another location. Another had just nearby Jabal Amel Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Ahmed Qasir. And
so which Amali was there? Which
I don't remember the names, but it was an attack, a suicide attack. And and in the interrogation I went in, there were four top majors. One of them was Abu Yusuf.
Mm-hmm.
He was Colonel Abu Yusuf. He was the man in charge of the Israelis in South Lebanon at the time. And you know, I remember when he was shouting at the soldier who was
dragging
me. Then, hey man, take it out! Don't you know that he is a journalist? You should respect him.
Mm.
Yeah, I understand that way of.
He's the good cop.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked me to sit down. He pointed to a pile of files. And he told me exactly, I remember the name. He said, listen, Akh Ali, do you mind if I call you Akh Ali?
He speaks Arabic?
Yeah, perfect.
Is he Arabic?
Maybe, I don't know. Colonel, but the accent is Arabic.
Mm.
Maybe. Colonel Yusuf.
Mm.
He said, see all these files? You write in Al-Kifah Al-Arabi by the name of Ali Al-Hashmi. You write in Al-Liwa magazine by the name of Walid Mas'ud. I was using these names to write in, just to hide out, just to try to avoid any being exposed.
Didn't you write with your name with any correspondence?
Yeah, I was, but I mean, these are all these files. All
these
your
are considered articles, resistance.
All your articles, all your photographs, everything is here. So we don't want to lie. I said okay. Nothing to lie about. And then he started. Most of the questions were about Muhammad Sa'ad, the resistance leader. Where do you meet with him? Where do you see him? How does he reach to you? How does he send you all these publications about their operations when they do some ambushes against the Israeli army, etc., etc.? And then I remember, and by the end of the day, someone came, knocked on the door, came in, and he handed him some kind of telegrams, you know. And he looked red and said, hey, you are a famous man. Everybody's talking about you.
Mm. What was that about?
All the news, because you know, I was in correspondence of all these magazines, all these newspapers.
Because you're arrested, everyone.
Exactly. Reuters, Agence France-Presse, and all the magazines were writing about.
Do you think it mattered?
No. They didn't. They couldn't convict me for anything. I was not that. You know, I was just a journalist.
Yeah. Did they?
They asked me to contribute to cooperate with them.
Uh-huh.
That's what he led me outside when I was. Mm-hmm. He said we will release you. He led me outside to take my, because when you go inside, they take everything from you.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was supposed to go out, he took me to that place. He gave me back my things, my watch, all that stuff. And on the way out, he said, do you want me to lead you to your house? You know, I can know my way.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, would you prefer to come back so we could collaborate together? I said, you want me to come back? You know my house. The same way you arrested me, you could come and arrest me anytime, no problem.
Did they disrespect you or torture you or anything?
No. It didn't happen. The only torture was this
bag.
Mm-hmm. The bag, and I was forced to sit down under the rain for about 3 hours, raining heavily.
When?
Before taking me into interrogation.
Outside.
They didn't. I know there are places in. Before I was inside a tent, they drove me outside under the rain. It was cold.
So you were drenched when they. Do you think they did this intentionally?
For sure. Trying to break you. This is some kind of. It might be considered as torture. Yeah.
Of course, it is. We want to stop at the year 1988, Doctor, and continue with the next episode from there. During these years, what are some of the memories that, if you were to pick one or two memories that are stuck with you the most during your correspondence, what would they be?
One of them was very essential to me because, you know, when resistance started the suicide attacks, the Israelis ordered that no one could drive the car alone because he would be a suspect that he might be coming to attack them or whatever. So anyone who will be a lone driver in the car, he might be shot and killed. What could I do? I'm a journalist. I remember my mom.
Mm-hmm.
She insisted in coming with me every time I go around. Just to, not to, to make, to put myself in danger. Yeah.
Amazing.
That, that mm-hmm. was something. What else I can tell you about? A lot of memories.
Mm-hmm. At that time, the Lebanese also Communist Party was resisting.
Yeah.
And they had the first actually operation.
Yeah. Yeah, several operations. One of them, the most famous, Suhab Shara, who tried to assassinate Lahad, Antoine Lahad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The environment of the intellectual environment at that time.
Mm.
What was it composed of?
I'll tell you something of my very personal experience. I managed to establish some kind of cultural community in the area, in Abbasi and the surrounding area. We used to have a weekly lecture where at the Husseiniyya and Abbasiyya, mm-hmm. and it would be crowded. And we used to use the Husseiniyya podium as a way to address the community, the people, how to
resist,
encouragement upon resistance.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out the same establishment or community I organized 1984. We started it. We continued later after the withdrawal of the Israelis from our part of South Lebanon, and then by 1990. Now it's called the Cultural Forum in Abbasi. It's one of the most prominent cultural associations in South Lebanon.
And it's continuing.
It's continued till now.
Mm. And you managed to do that while teaching, while doing the correspondence for about 15 news agencies.
Yeah.
One last question, Doctor. 1979, the success of the Islamic Revolution in Iran.
78.
Yeah. What was the repercussions in the immediate repercussions in Lebanon?
To be frank enough, we were in the middle of fire, you know, civil war. 1978 was the first Israeli
occupation.
But on the other hand, we should never ever forget the strength of our links with Iran as an Islamic, as Shiite
state.
But despite this fact, at that time, we didn't have. It wasn't clear enough when it started.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't there was some kind of joy that we have at last a Shiite state alive.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't recall that it did this much of change in maybe you could feel the impact of this revolution started to take its shape by within, I mean, after the second invasion, a few years after 1982, 83.
When did it become obvious?
1983-84, when the Islamic Islamic resistance in South Lebanon started showing up, starting with the operation, the most successful suicide operation led by Ahmed Qasir in nearby Sur. Yeah.
And was it clear the presence of the Iranian flag of the Iranian soldiers or trainers?
Not at all.
Okay. Sayyid Musa Sadr, you were in the heart of the time where he was one of the prominent leaders in your area. Yeah. What's your memories of Sayyid Musa Sadr?
Rarely. I remember I met him twice in Nadi al-Imam al-Sadiq, Sur. He used to come, you know, he was always there. But I don't have a direct connection with him, no.
Mm-hmm. Did he influence the intellectual environment at that time? Did you...
Yeah, he was a controversial person.
Mm-hmm.
From one side, yes, he was very... famous in among those with the liberated minds, those who really thinks differently. He did a lot of things in Sur area that was strange enough to others, mainly to the religious scholars. And if, for example, the story, the very famous story that he went to this Christian man that was selling ice cream, and this man was boycotted by others because he's Christian. He went there and sit down in his office on the pavement, and he ordered ice cream and with his friends who were coming with him, just to deviate this this image that this is a Christian guy and we should boycott him.
Why was he boycotted? And that's
because at that time some people would say that he is doing something haram. He is not doing it via the Islamic rules or all that stuff. You know.
So there was questions about how halal, how Islamically legitimate was the ice cream that he's making.
Yeah.
Nothing personal about No.
But I mean, this thing which he did gave him a bright image among most of those people of Sur, Christians and Muslims.
So when you say controversial in that sense,
yeah.
So the Islamic environment before Sayyid Musa Sadr is more traditional.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. With him, he started. That's why, and this is a good thing to say. That's why he faced a lot of opponents, a lot of them, among Islamic scholars within Sur. I don't want to say names, but I know a lot of them, Mashaykh. They really opposed him.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them fought against him. Some of them even started to create some kind of fictitious scandals about him, trying to link him to this or that, or this or that, sometimes bad reputational stories. It comes in this sense because I'm sure that this specific group of scholars, they found a real threat by this liberated line Imam Musa Sadr was leading. He was really something completely different from all or most of the other religious leaders that passed to the Shiite or in general to Islamic history in Lebanon.
Thank you, Dr. Ajami, for your time and for this very insightful look at the early history of your career in Lebanon. We will continue, hopefully, with the upcoming episodes. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Wissam Sharafuddin. Thank you for listening to our podcast, and see you next episode.
Thank you.